$1 apiece for those press. So. And, thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Cash America versus Bennett.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Daly will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioner will reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Please support. Honors, my name is Richard Daly. I represent Cash America International Petitioner. When a pawnbroker is unable to return pledged property to a customer because, as the case is here, the property has been stolen, the Pawn Shop Act requires the pawnbroker to replace that property with like-kind merchandise. The replacement is subject to approval by the Consumer Credit Commission. The interpretation of this law prompts three issues. The first being, did the legislature intend to modify the common law remedies available in this situation, or did it merely intend to provide a choice of remedies? The second being, if the legislature intended to modify the common law remedies, does that violate the open court provision of the Constitution? And the third being, does that violate the right to trial by jury?
After the amendments of September 1, 1999, is all that really left on the table for us?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, I was going to only briefly touch on that, and so I'll do that now. And that's that the first issue, whether what the legislature intended to do, was certainly amended by the September amendments, where the legislature changed the law to say that now specifically, pledgers are required to exhaust their administrative remedies prior to seeking a remedy at trial. So I think with this court's opinion in Holder v. Wood in 1986, which states that changes affecting remedies or procedure may be retroactive, then that issue has already been taken care of by our legislature. And I don't think, unless the court has more questions on the issue, that I'll address it.
Well, let me make sure. What if we were to decide that that statute only applies prospectively, that it doesn't have retroactive effect, then what is your interpretation of the how the appellate process would work under the old statute?
I think it's exactly the same as it would work now. I think what the legislature intended to do was merely clarify what the law is. And the reason for that is this. If you look at the way these cases came up through the Court of Appeals, you'll see that in 1996, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals came out with the K.L. decision, in which the Corpus Christi Court said that the pledgers were required to exhaust their administrative remedies. The legislature did nothing after that opinion.
Well, but isn't that case distinguishable from this one on its facts?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is at all. I think that the distinction that the respondent tries to make, that the plaintiff there made the choice of remedies, is a minor distinction that I don't think bears on the relevance of this. Going back to what the legislature did do then, in 1998, the first Court of Appeals came out with a decision in this case and said that, no, that the legislature merely intended to provide a choice of remedies. Immediately, the legislature changed the law.
But under the pre-existing law, it says if you're aggrieved by a decision, the final decision of the commissioner, then you're entitled to judicial review, and it seems like the statute provided for judicial review under the government code, 2001 government code. Is that correct?
It does say that, and that is an interpretation of it, and I think to copy one of the prior arguments, I think it was merely a piece of sloppy legislation. I think nobody sat down and thought how this would go out.
But nonetheless, that's what it says.
That's correct.
So you would not have a de novo jury trial under the old statute.
Well, I think that they intended that to be the case. I think that the statute itself does say that you're entitled to judicial review, but I think implicit in the way the act was formed and the remedies that are provided, I think implicit was that there would be a jury trial.
Show me where that's implicit.
What
section of the act do you say it's implied from?
Well, I think it's implied in the sense that the Act provides that the pawnbroker shall provide like-kind merchandise, and once the Consumer Credit Commissioner makes a decision whether or not the replacement property is actually like-kind merchandise, then I think there has to be some review available.
But is it a de novo jury trial? Do you get a common law claims trial? What is the review under the statute as it existed in 97?
As it existed in 1997, we argued that the review would be a de novo jury trial on the issues as modified, the issues being, first, whether or not the individual is entitled to like-kind merchandise, and then second, whether or not the merchandise is actually like-kind.
And what section is that found in?
It's not. And I admittedly, the legislature does not explain how this remedy would go through the courts.
Why wouldn't it be governed by Chapter 2001 of the Government Code? Wouldn't it be substantial evidence under the code?
Well, I don't think that that's what the legislature intended, and I merely only state that based on what the legislature did once the Court of Appeals came out with its decision. Because, quite honestly, when Cash America said, "What do we do about this?" and I said, "Well, you lobby the legislator and tell them to clarify themselves." And in fact, they did that. And so our argument is merely based on, with hindsight, going forward, what the legislature did based on the amendments in 1999. So, and I think you're correct, and I admit that it can be interpreted to be a judicial review under the Administrative Procedure Act, but I don't think that's what the legislature intended by virtue.
Well, that's what they said.
Well, it is what they said until the amendments came out. The question thus becomes whether the law violates the open courts provision.
Would you agree that the commissioner does not have the authority to grant the relief sought in the district court?
No, I would not agree with that.
Well, I mean, aren't they two different remedies that we're talking about?
Well,
I mean, conversion gives you reasonable market value, and the statute gives you a replacement of like-kind merchandise. Aren't those two different remedies?
In that context, they are, but the legislature here has changed the remedy.
Well, again, so two different remedies. I mean, the commissioner does not have the authority to decide reasonable market value.
I'm sorry, to decide reasonable market value, or you mean to decide?
Reasonable market value, which is the conversion measure of damages. The commissioner does not have the authority to do that, to award reasonable market value.
I think they do, and let me show you what provision that is. In section 371.302 of the Finance Code, the power is given to the Consumer Credit Commissioner to request the Attorney General or other attorneys authorized to sue for an injunction or damages on behalf of an aggrieved individual. So I think in that instance, yes, it does give.
But that's not under the Pawn Shop Act.
Yes, 371.302. Just as 371.167 gives the commissioner the power to approve the like-kind replacement, and 371.301 gives the commissioner the power to issue penalties to a pawnbroker.
But it can't award a plaintiff reasonable market value.
It cannot per se award the plaintiff without it going through the courts. That is correct. But it does have the power to put that into motion.
Let me ask you this. In the Court of Appeals opinion, it says something that I don't see you all have argued, and I don't see a citation or an appendix concerning this. The Court of Appeals says the Act provides that if the customer is dissatisfied with the final decision of the commissioner, that party may file suit against the commissioner is entitled to judicial review. Where is that found?
Where is that found in the Act?
Yes.
That is found in the Government Code. No, I'm sorry, it's not. It's found in section 14 point, I'm not sure the exact site, of the finance code, and I think what that says is that a person who is aggrieved by an act of the commissioner is entitled to judicial review.
Okay.
And recall that that's under the old act. While that's still there, now under the act as amended, the legislature has specifically provided that the pledger must exhaust an administrative remedy with respect to the property before seeking a remedy in court, and then specifically authorizes the individual to seek a remedy in court after 91 days. Continuing with the open courts analysis, this court addressed what the test was in the Garcia case, the landmark workers' compensation case, where the court said that the legislative action withdrawing common law remedies for injuries to one's property is sustained only when A, it is reasonable in substituting other remedies, or B, when it is a reasonable exercise of the police power in the interest of the general welfare. The court then stated that in determining whether or not a substitute remedy is a reasonable remedy, you have to compare the substitute remedy to the common law remedy. So here you would be comparing the like-kind merchandise remedy to the common law remedy. As this court showed in Garcia, in order to recover common law, for example, in a negligence claim, the individual would have to not only prove the elements of negligence, duty, breach of duty, proximate cause, damages, but then also overcome all of the common law defenses. In this situation, which is even a bailment situation, there's only a rebuttable presumption of negligence when property is not returned. But again, it's a rebuttable presumption, which may be rebutted by proof that there was some other cause that was consistent with due care.
How does your argument apply to a conversion?
Well, conversion is even harder to prove in this case, Your Honor. In conversion, you have to prove an intentional act of dominion or control wrongfully.
If I make a demand from you as North America to return my ring, and you say, no, I can't do that, that seems to be an intentional response, not to return, whatever the reason is.
Well, but in this situation, we're talking about lost or stolen property, in which it's not an intentional act of control, it's an unintentional.
But in the conversion theory and availment, it was for the mutual benefit of the parties, and if you don't give it up when they ask for it, you converted it. Isn't that just hornbook law?
No, I don't think it is. In fact, I think conversion is a remedy that you don't win in this situation because it is an intentional tort. I think more likely you're going to win a negligence action or a bailment action. But the legislature has seen fit to do away with all that and say you don't have to make any proof of these elements, and all you have to do is prove that you didn't receive the property. Now you're entitled to like-kind merchandise. Just like under the Workers' Compensation Act, all you have to do is prove you're injured. You're entitled to the provisions or the remedies available under the Workers' Compensation Act.
Let me ask you, are those issues having to do with remedies properly raised here? In the trial court, the trial court granted the plea of the jurisdiction because of failure to exhaust administrative remedies, and it goes to the Court of Appeals, and the issue before the Court of Appeals was whether exhaustion of remedies was required, and the Court of Appeals said no, it was not, and reversed and remanded the trial court. In the Court of Appeals, was an issue raised before them that the statute limiting remedies was unconstitutional? Or was the issue in the Court of Appeals simply that the statute did not require exhaustion of remedies, and if it did require exhaustion of remedies, then the statute was unconstitutional because it violated open courts? Was the issue of the remedies available under the statute before the Court of Appeals?
I think you're correct, Your Honor. That's exactly right, a point that I hadn't considered, that it was not before the Court of Appeals by the respondent or the petitioner at that stage.
The issue that was raised and decided in the Court of Appeals was simply whether or not there was an exhaustion of remedies required, the Court of Appeals said there was not, and the alternate point that was raised that if exhaustion of remedies was required, exhaustion of the administrative process was required, then the statute was a violation of the open courts provision. And the Court of Appeals didn't reach that question because they decided exhaustion of administrative remedies was not necessary.
That's right. That's right. The Court of Appeals decided that it wasn't necessary merely because it wasn't expressly stated so in the Act. And now that it is stated so in the Act, then the exhaustion of remedies is necessary. So the question is it a reasonable substitute for the available common law remedies in order to be provided like-kind merchandise? And the answer to that is you bet it is, just like it was under the Workers' Compensation Act, where an individual is entitled to the remedies available under that act by virtue of just showing that it's injured. Except for in this instance, you're not giving up as much as you are in the Workers' Compensation Act. This court stated that that although the remedy would be somewhat limited, it would be also much more certain. In this instance, the remedy is not limited. It is more certain, but it's not limited because presumably like-kind merchandise entails merchandises which is both comparable in quality and value. So you should be able to receive the same value without having to prove any of the elements common law damages. The final question is whether or not the Act infringes upon the right to a jury trial, and I think undeniably no. And, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Mark McLean, the argument for the respondent.
May it please the Court, counsel.
Do we apply the amendment retroactively?
Unless the statute says it applies itself retroactively, I believe the general rule is it's prospective application.
But aren't there cases that say if it affects a remedy, it's to be applied retroactively?
I think it's procedural. And the problem with this statute that we're operating under, as it existed at the time that we brought our lawsuit, you can't. Now, I think the Court of Appeals in this case squarely faced the issue. And when you're looking at whether or not the court has jurisdiction to entertain a common law conversion suit in a pawnbroker type situation, you can't ignore, I don't believe, a constitutional analysis because the Court of Appeals referenced the Holman case, which was the payday law, and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. You have to take a look at what the remedy is available.
Well, let me just follow up on my question because I'm not sure I got an answer. If we were to find that the amendments are retroactive because it affects a matter of procedure, would you have any quarrel with your opponent's position? I mean, do you still have an argument? Because, you're not claiming that the statute as amended is unconstitutional.
I'm sorry?
Well, the statute as amended requires exhaustion. You agree with that?
The statute as amended requires exhaustion. I believe that's a probable interpretation, but I'm not sure of the kind of administrative review that's going to be required under the amended statute.
Okay, so then are you saying you would still have a constitutional problem?
We might, because there's three magic words missing in the amendment, trial de novo. It just says you can go into court for a remedy. It doesn't specify anything. And under the with the amended provisions, you still have the infirmity, the constitutional infirmity, when you're comparing what kind of remedy is available, because there is no right to a jury trial, because if the person disagrees with whatever the commissioner does or doesn't do, then under the Administrative Procedure Act, we have to go through a contested case hearing, and then the ultimate review is by judicial review. And as the court is well aware, that there is no right to a trial by jury.
Did under the new act or the amended statute? statute, did they do away with the Administrative Procedure Act review or not? Is it still there?
As far as I know, it's still there. I just recently got those amendments a week or two ago. Just went through them. I just focused on the language that, to me, is relevant here. The appendices attached to my brief was the research I did about what happens if the commissioner makes a decision that somebody doesn't like. And the other thing is that another infirmity in the statute, still the commissioner has no authority to render a money judgment in favor of somebody who has a conversion cause of action.
It seems, Mr. McClain, have you, the issue that you took to the Court of Appeals was the issue of whether exhaustion of remedies, exhaustion of the administrative proceedings was required. The trial court dismissed based on that claim. It goes to the Court of Appeals. And your complaint was that exhaustion of administrative proceedings was not required by the statute. And if it was required by the statute, it was unconstitutional. Now, we're not at the point where you're complaining that somehow some remedy is unconstitutionally deprived from you. It seems to me that fits the argument of whether or not there's an exhaustion of administrative remedies is required under this statute. There might be some arguments about the different remedies that would be available and whether or not it was designed to preempt some of those. But the real issue that you had in the Court of Appeals was simply, is requiring exhaustion of the administrative proceedings unconstitutional as a violation of the open court's provision? Isn't that the issue that was presented to the Court of Appeals and decided by the Court of Appeals?
Well, some clarification.
Okay.
Our position was at the Court of Appeals that there's no such thing as primary jurisdiction, that that was a creature that the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals invented because the statute is silent on the issue. There's nothing in that statute that says anything about exclusive jurisdiction with the commissioner. I mean, it's absolutely silent. So my position was that there's nothing that says that way. We're talking about a common law cause of action on the constitutional dimension of conversion. And if we're going to have a statute that plainly says, if giving effect to their credence and their arguments, if the statute says you get a replacement, that is in derogation of a common law right that existed before the Constitution of 1876. There, you've got a silent statute. You've got no authority in the commissioner to render the kind of judgment. So even if you did apply the primary jurisdiction rule that the Corpus Christi Court invented for this statute, you still have a judicial, is it an inherently judicial cause of action? You still, so we approached it that, number one, this statute is unconstitutional. That's the only relief somebody can get. Number two, there is no primary exclusive grant of primary jurisdiction in the commissioner. And number three, even if there is something called primary jurisdiction that the statute is silent on, this is a case that's inherently judicial in nature. It fits one of the exceptions. That's what we took to the Court of Appeals. I don't know any other simpler way to put it. The Court of Appeals did not get to the constitutionality issue because they ruled, as we believe, that a person has an election. They can make an election if
they're... Is it your view that the doctrine of primary jurisdiction is not part of Texas law? I mean, that it's just...
I'm saying it's not a part of law under this statute because the statute does not specifically give primary jurisdiction to the commissioner.
But does the doctrine of primary jurisdiction actually require a statutory grant of primary jurisdiction in order to be invoked under Texas law?
I believe it does when you're talking about a cause of action for conversion, when the remedy that the commissioner can give is completely abrogates that remedy.
What authority do you have that before the doctrine of primary jurisdiction can be invoked, it must be expressly included in a statute?
That I tailored that back into the Article 1, Section 13 analysis that this Court's done on many occasions where a statute abrogates a common law remedy. And the problem,
what is your definition of primary jurisdiction?
Primary jurisdiction exists where an agency has particular things committed to it. Texas Air Control Board, I think, would be an example. If somebody's applying for a permit to dump waste or garbage. There's a whole process they have to go through to get different kind of permits. Agencies in that situation are statutorily created to handle that sort of thing. They have the expertise on the staff because having sat through one of those for several months at a time, it does require people that know what they're doing.
Well, isn't the doctrine of primary jurisdiction then, as you defined it, a creature of the common law that is used to reconcile jurisdictional questions as between agencies and courts to avoid the kinds of constitutional problems that you're talking about?
My belief is, Your Honor, that it's a creature of statutory construction because the court...
But it is, in fact, used then by the courts to help reconcile agency authority versus court authority and to avoid the kinds of constitutional problems that you're talking about.
I don't know about avoiding constitutional problems, but I do know that it's used to put, I guess, the burden where it belongs on the agency that's charged with responsibility. I think that's, I hope that answers your question. I think it's the best I can give. But this statute suffered from two constitutional infirmities that I saw, and our approach and our complaint to the Court of Appeals was there's no exclusive grant. It's an election. The injured party ought to be able to elect which one they want to go. And it meets, this case, it does, I believe, meets all the requirements of a Section 13 challenge. And the Court of Appeals, I think, if you read the opinion, to preserve the constitutionality of the statute without having to get into the nuts and bolts of it, in trying to uphold the constitutionality, they made the decision that people have an election they can make. Some people can go to the commissioner and get their like-kind replacement. There's a remedy that's been available to people since the 1860s, and they can go to the route and get reasonable market value through a court. And that's the approach that we took. One thing that I would like to comment on briefly is some of the amicus briefs. I should say amicus briefs, plural, mentioned that some kind of floodgate of litigation analysis, if we allow people to sue pawn shops when property's been converted. And I did an analysis and tried to count the number of cases that's made their way to the appellate level where a pawn shop has been sued either by a disgruntled customer or somebody who had their property stolen. And I could only come up with five, at the most six cases since 1908. That was the Uncle Sam's case.
And even if that argument had some substance to it, would it in effect no longer be effective with the amendment?
I still think it's open to question, Your Honor, because, I mean, I don't know what kind of review an injured person's going to get. It says, the statute says, you've got 90 days, the commissioner can decide a reasonable or a replacement. If either side's unhappy, then within 90 days they can go to court for a remedy. Perhaps that does cure the problem, if people are entitled to a full range of remedies, but it shouldn't affect Ms. Bennett. Ms. Bennett made her election under the old law. Our case was filed in 97. The facts are basically that for 4 months, she did everything in her power to work with Cash America to find a replacement. She looked at they sent her magazines with her jewelry. She went and looked at all the different jewelry things that they had to offer. I mean, it was an exhaustive thing for 4 months. I'm not sure what purpose would be served going to the commissioner at this point.
If the court determined that the trial court was correct, that you filed your lawsuit too early, that you needed to go to the commissioner, you could go to the commissioner, get the commissioner to make a determination, and then you could, if you didn't like that, you could file suit, and one of the complaints you could make is that the commissioner either didn't provide you the remedies the common law otherwise provides you, and if the statute prohibits that, then it's unconstitutional. I mean, all the issues you raise about the remedies aspect of it, under statute could all be raised after you've had your opportunity to go before the commissioner to have him or her resolve the initial property dispute.
I really don't think that's necessary, Your Honor, at this stage of the game. I think we ought to. Even if you look at the analysis of what the commissioner can do now, I mean, 90 days, if we had a claim today, fine. Go look at it for 90 days. What can the commissioner do that hasn't already been done in this case? Nothing. The election was made under the law as it existed at the time my client's claim arose. I don't see where we would be served by going back and starting something over again, especially in view of the statute as it existed at the time that had no exclusive grant of primary jurisdiction. Even in terms of judicial economy, I don't see how that would help anybody in this case, because my client will pursue a conversion common law remedy, and regardless of what the commissioner does or doesn't do, unless, you know, that's just not going to happen. I mean, she worked with him for 4 months. Unless the court has any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Daly, are the amendments retroactive?
May I please the court? Yes, they are.
And why? Why is that?
The Holder versus Wood case, I think, is determined. That case was an action, was a DTPA action that was filed in 1983 against the seller of a mobile home. Apparently, the mobile home was faulty in some way or another. While the case was pending, the law was amended in 1985 with regard to mobile home manufacturers, and it required individuals who wanted to file certain DTPA actions against these manufacturers to seek to exhaust their administrative remedies first. In a mandamus action, this court held that because it was a procedural or remedial amendment, that the law applied retroactively. So accordingly, the court went back and abated the lawsuit with regard to some of the actions, because some of the actions weren't covered by the suit. But I think
this statute remedial? Is this statute remedial? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, it's certainly procedural and possibly remedial. And the reason I say that is because it's certainly procedural because it requires an individual to at least exhaust their administrative remedies before filing a common law cause of action. But I think it's possibly remedial because I think it can also be interpreted as substituting the remedy of like-kind merchandise for the remedy that you are entitled to under the common law. But it's certainly procedural, and the court was clear in the Holder versus Wood case that a procedural change may be applied retroactively.
Are you of the opinion that the amendment in no way diminishes or decreases or eliminates any substantive claim that the plaintiff may have had before the amendment?
No, I don't think it does. I think they have the same rights. I think the law was just a clarification. When I was sitting there, I was going back through the recent amendments, and I noticed, and this is obviously not determinative, but it is somewhat persuasive, that another one of the amended sections of the Pawn Shop Act provides the changes in the law made by this act to sections 371.059 and 371.071, which are not an issue here, of the finance code, apply only to applications filed on or after the effective date of the act. But they didn't say that with regard to the amendment in this provision. Now, I think we can fully assume that legislature knew what the law was, knew that they were making a procedural and or remedial change, and knew that it could be applied retroactively.
Well, as long as we would say that Bennett's case is just abated and give her an opportunity to go have the commissioner deal with this, it seems to me that would be okay to have a remedial retroactive application of this deal. But that wouldn't be a basis for affirming the trial court's, supporting the trial court's judgment. We should dismiss their case because they didn't bring the administrative process. Because it seems if you argued that that would apply, then potentially their statute of limitations would have run. Because you got a 90-day appeal from the commissioner's ruling, and they never got a commissioner's ruling. You know, so the question, they'd have a difficult time, it seems to me, reinstating their lawsuit several years later. You said, well, we've got to dismiss this because they never brought their administrative remedies. It wasn't clearly required in the first statute.
Right. I think that's correct, and I think the reason it was couched as a motion to dismiss was merely because that's the way it was couched in the Cal case. I don't think it makes any difference to Cash America or any other pawn shop whether or not it's an abatement or a motion to dismiss, because they're certainly not trying to take away an individual's remedy, but merely say you have to go and follow this, the administrative remedy first before you're entitled to Commonwealth.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in this cause, and all the arguments today are submitted on briefs and oral arguments.